Sunday, the 28th of November 2004, was a normal day for the Wilson family from Nairn in Scotland. Father Alistair and Mother Veronica had spent much of the day entertaining their two children, Andrew and Graham, with walks on the beach as well as socialising with friends. When the doorbell of their proud Victorian villa at 10 Crescent Road rang at about 7 p.m, Veronica assumed it would be the parents of a young child they were looking after, coming to collect him. They would normally have entered through the back door, but Veronica thought maybe it had been accidentally locked, so they went to the front of the house instead. She put down the laundry she was sorting out and went downstairs to answer the door. To her surprise, she found a stranger on the doorstep, who simply said, quote, "Alistair Wilson?" Veronica didn't recognise the man, but didn't think much about it, assuming he had something to do with her husband's job as a banker. She left the man on the doorstep and returned upstairs to get Alistair, who had just settled down to read his boys a story. Veronica took over reading the story and Alistair went to the front door. After a few minutes, Alistair reappeared upstairs, seeming confused by the conversation he had just had with the visitor. He was clutching a blue envelope with the name Paul written on the front of it, which he showed to Veronica. He decided to go back downstairs to talk to the man further. A few minutes later, he would be left dying on his own doorstep, having been shot 3 times. What would follow would be the most expensive police investigation in Scottish history, but despite this, no arrests would be made, and many questions remain unresolved. What was the motive for the murder? Who was the unidentified killer that arrived on the Wilsons' doorstep? Was he a disgruntled customer of the bank? A jealous husband? A hitman sent by a third party? What did he and Alistair discuss that evening? What were the contents of the blue envelope? Who is Paul? This is the confusing story of the murder of Alistair Wilson. Before getting into the case, just a quick note about the show. The Silent Evidence is a fortnightly true crime podcast focusing on missing persons, unsolved murders, or cases in which there is some controversy surrounding a conviction. It is hosted by me, Alexander Knox. It can be found across multiple platforms including iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, YouTube, and many more. If you have questions, case suggestions, or just want to get in touch, navigate to www.thesilentevidence.com. Tweet me at thesilentevpod, that's at thesilentevpod. Find me on Instagram at thesilentevidence, or search for the Silent Evidence podcast on Facebook. The Silent Evidence is a complete one-man show, so if you enjoy it and would like to contribute to its continuation, please consider supporting me on Patreon. The page can be found at www.patreon.com/thesilentevidence. And finally, please subscribe, like, rate, or review on whichever platform you're listening on. Part 1, Introduction. Alistair Wilson was born on the 4th of March 1974 in Ayrshire, in the southwest of Scotland. He led a relatively quiet childhood, growing up with his sister Gillian. He enjoyed listening to music and impressed his teachers with his intelligence, particularly his aptitude with numbers. Upon completing high school, he decided to study accountancy and business law at Stirling University, putting his numerical skills to good use. In 1996, he took up a graduate trainee position with the Bank of Scotland and was sent to work in Fort William in the Scottish Highlands. It was in Fort William that he met Veronica, a graphic designer, and the two began a whirlwind romance, resulting in Alistair proposing just 6 weeks later, and the couple were married shortly afterwards. Alistair's intelligence and developing business acumen saw him climb the ladder within the Bank of Scotland quickly and resulted in a transfer to Edinburgh, the Scottish capital, followed by a move to the picturesque market town of Peebles in the Scottish Borders, where he took up his first bank manager position. 2 years later, he and Veronica would move to Nairn, where Alistair took up the role of business manager at the local Bank of Scotland branch, which would become HBOS after a merger with the Halifax Bank. They started a family, with sons Andrew and Graham being born shortly afterwards. The family bought a guest house at 10 Crescent Road, and although the business was not successful, forcing them to close the premises to guests, they retained the property as a family home, even converting the top floor into a self-contained flat for Veronica's elderly father Ronnie to live in. The house was situated on a quiet residential street behind the main road with a small pub opposite, the Havelock Hotel, where Alistair would occasionally enjoy a drink. The town of Nairn is home to approximately 11,000 people. It's an ancient fishing port and market town in the north of Scotland, about half an hour's drive from Inverness. It is known for its award-winning beaches and fine golf courses, and the Wilsons felt it was the perfect place to raise their family. Even before they moved to Nairn, they enjoyed spending weekends there, walking along the very beach they now had a view of from their home. Alistair's love of golf drew him to the area too, although he had less time for his hobbies now, with two young children to look after. They fitted in well to the community and were well liked by the locals. Part 2. The Case. On the weekend of the 27th and 28th of November 2004, Alistair had invited friends to come and stay with them in Nairn. He and Veronica had spent much of the Saturday cleaning the house in preparation for their friend's arrival and clearing away Christmas wrapping and the presents they had bought for their young children. Their friends arrived by tea time, and after the kids were put to bed, they had a nice evening catching up. The following day, Sunday the 28th, the two fathers went trekking with the older children in the nearby woods and on the beach, while the two mothers took the younger children to a play centre. They all met up again in the early afternoon for lunch and to say their goodbyes as the friends returned home. Alistair spent the rest of the day running typical weekend errands with his eldest son, visiting the supermarket to pick up something for dinner that evening, and washing the car. The rest of the afternoon and early evening passed unremarkably until the doorbell rang at approximately 7 p.m. Veronica described the visitor as white, of stocky build, 35 to 40 years old, and standing about 5 foot 6 to 5 foot 10 inches tall. He was wearing a dark-coloured baseball cap that was pulled down low, obscuring much of his face, but she could see that he was clean-shaven. He was wearing a dark blue blouson-style jacket and dark jeans. Veronica did not feel threatened or anxious in any way about the man, and indeed left him standing by the open front door while she returned upstairs to get Alistair. The exchange between Alistair and the man at the front door lasted only a couple of minutes before Veronica recalled him returning upstairs. She recalled him coming into the boy's bedroom, carrying a blue-coloured envelope that the man had given him, the type that would come with a birthday card, with the name Paul written on the front of it. Just as strange, the envelope was empty. Veronica said Alistair seemed confused by the exchange. She said, quote, "He was just a bit bewildered as to what the gentleman had said, because the envelope wasn't addressed to him." Veronica confirmed to her husband that the man had asked for him by name. After a brief discussion, Alistair insisted on going back downstairs to see if the man was still there. Veronica later said, quote, "There was no fear, otherwise I wouldn't have let him go back downstairs." The man was indeed still on the doorstep. After a few moments, Veronica heard a loud noise, which at first she thought was wooden pallets falling over. After rushing downstairs, though, she found her husband lying on the ground. She described the scene, quote, "I don't know what I'm expecting to find. Al's lying there. I think he's been hit. You know, the guy's punched him. I ran over and he's covered in blood." Alistair had been shot 3 times at close range, 2 shots to the head and once to the body. He was still breathing and showing signs of consciousness, but was bleeding very heavily. After finding her husband on the ground, Veronica was hysterical. While attending to him, trying to stop the blood, she seen the visitor leaving the scene, walking down Crescent Road to her left. She grabbed towels from the house to try to stem the blood loss and called emergency services. Upon hearing Veronica's cries, several people ran across the road from the Havelock Hotel to try to help, including an off-duty nurse and the hotel chef, Stuart Wright. Mr. Wright later recalled, quote, "I remember after seeing his body was taken away, Veronica was just sitting on the front steps with her head in her hands. She looked completely alone and distraught." The couple's eldest son, only 4 years old at the time, came out and seen his father lying on the doorstep. Alistair died an hour later in hospital. Part 3. The Investigation. The police arrived and conducted a search of the crime scene and interviewed potential witnesses. Two people who were standing outside of the Havelock Hotel when the visitor arrived at the Wilsons' home recalled seeing him, but didn't see his face. The best description remained the one from Veronica, who answered the door to him. During an appeal several years later, the police would reveal that they also recovered a cigarette butt from the area in the vicinity of the doorstep that may have been discarded by the visitor, and may contain a DNA profile. Police trawled through CCTV from 670 sources around the town, but could not positively identify the man on any of them. There was a CCTV camera pointing down Crescent Road itself, but frustratingly, it had developed a fault earlier that very day and wasn't working at the time of Alistair's murder. Perhaps just as interesting as what was found, though, was what was not found. The blue envelope that the visitor gave to Alistair, and that had subsequently been shown to his wife, was not recovered at the scene. It had presumably been taken away by the killer. Police puzzled over the significance of this. Some 10 days after the murder, on the 8th of December, council worker Andy McMahon was called to Seabank Road in Nairn to clean up the mess from a blocked drain on the street. It's a wide residential street with impressive houses and guesthouses lining it, and a large Victorian-era church at the junction with the main road linking Nairn to Inverness. As he was cleaning the area, he peered into the now unblocked drain and something caught his eye. He lifted the grating and, wearing rubber gloves, reached down and pulled out a gun. He told the police, quote, "First of all, I thought it was a dummy gun because of the size of it. It was tiny. It wasn't until I got the gun out and felt the weight of it that I realised it wasn't a toy." It was an antique 1920s Haino Schmeisser semi-automatic, often nicknamed a pocket pistol or a handbag gun due to its small size. About 40,000 of them were made in Germany before World War II, but they are very rare in the UK. Indeed, only 11 had been recovered over the previous 10 years. 5 were handed in to police after an elderly relative had died, 2 were given up during amnesties, and 4 were used in crimes. Tests revealed that the handgun recovered from the drain was the weapon that was used in Alistair's murder, but the investigation was dealt a huge blow when no identifiable DNA was found on the gun. The police were hopeful, though, that the uniqueness of the gun would help someone identify it, and pictures were released to the media. Unfortunately, no leads were uncovered. 3 months after the murder, police asked local men to submit DNA samples, and over 1,000 samples were volunteered. They also offered a £10,000 reward for information to help the inquiry. 1 year after the murder, they released Veronica's 999 emergency call and footage of a psychologist breaking the news of their father's death to the couple's young children, all with the aim of tugging at someone's conscience and getting the breakthrough the investigation desperately needed. To date, the police have spoken to 14,000 people at 1,000 different addresses and have taken 3,500 statements, but have not yet secured a conviction. Many twists and turns have occurred over the years. From a document being sent to the UK's leading criminal profiler, Professor David Wilson, from an anonymous source claiming to know who was responsible and why, to an unidentified caller phoning a national radio chat show with an intriguing story, to the release of a book on the crime by an ex-police officer claiming to have uncovered new evidence. Despite all of this, the fundamental questions remain unanswered. Who was the man that arrived on the doorstep on that November night in 2004? How did he know Alistair Wilson? Did he indeed know him at all? Why did he hand him a blue envelope with Paul written on it? Why did he allow Alistair to go back into his house with the envelope and close the door behind him? Why didn't he shoot him straight away? Was he expecting Alistair to put something into the envelope? Who was responsible for Alistair's death? Many theories have been put forward over the years. Was the gunman a disgruntled customer of Alistair's bank? A jealous husband looking to blackmail him, or simply looking for revenge? Was the visitor a hitman sent by a third party? If so, who sent him? Was Alistair involved in criminal activity and silenced before he could turn whistleblower? Was his wife somehow involved, and if so, why? Was he killed over a petty dispute with the owner of the nearby Havelock Hotel? Or was it a case of mistaken identity? Part 4. The Evidence. The blue envelope addressed to Paul is an intriguing aspect of this case. To date, no one has been able to put forward a definitive answer as to what the significance of the envelope is. Presumably, the killer took the envelope away with him after the murder, as it was not recovered at the scene. If the envelope was so important to the killer that he didn't want to leave it behind, why did he give it to Alistair in the first place? Not only did he give it to him, he allowed him to take it into his house, closing the door behind him, and to show it to his wife. How could he know Alistair would come back to the front door with the envelope? He could have just as easily have left it in the house, or not returned to the door at all. The details of what was discussed between Alistair and his wife in between his two visits to the front door are not known. The police have asked Veronica to remain silent about what they spoke about. Presumably, they want this information to only be known to the killer should they ever charge someone with the crime. This also inevitably means that we do not know what Alistair and the killer discussed either. The only statement that Veronica has made about her conversation with Alistair was that he seemed confused by his conversation with the visitor. It was not until several years after the crime that police revealed that the blue envelope was allegedly empty and had Paul written on it. This leads to the possibility that the killer wanted Alistair to put something into the envelope. But what? Surely money was unlikely. The envelope was described as being small, about the quarter the size of a sheet of A4 paper. How much money could fit in there? And who keeps stashes of money at home anyway, even in 2004? Surely not a banker of all people. Perhaps he demanded that Alistair put something else into the envelope. Did he have some document at home related to his role at the bank that the killer wanted? Was it a USB stick? Did he give the envelope to Alistair and instruct him to go and discuss it with his wife? Was his intention not to have Alistair put anything in the envelope at all, but instead to simply make sure that its existence was discussed by the press? Was it important to the killer to have the name Paul circulated in the media, perhaps as a warning to someone? Maybe the envelope was symbolic of sending a message to warn someone to keep quiet. If this was the case though, wouldn't it be easier to have just left the envelope next to Alistair's body after shooting him, rather than the elaborate method of allowing him to return indoors and show it to his wife? Birmingham University criminologist Dr. Mohammed Rachman examined the events of that November night and believes Alistair's work at the bank is the key to solving the crime. He said, quote, "I believe that there is some substance to the name Paul. It could have been related to Alistair's work, or it could have been a pseudonym for a person or a project that he was working on, or an abbreviation of some sort that only Alistair knew of." In 2004, just weeks before Alistair's murder, Paul Moore was sacked from his role as head of risk management at HBOS after raising concerns surrounding the bank's cavalier loan strategy. Sir James Crosby was at the time the chief executive of HBOS and a director of the Financial Standards Agency, the FSA, a position to which he was personally appointed by Gordon Brown, then the British Prime Minister. It was the role of the FSA to investigate allegations of financial malpractice, and Paul Moore also criticised Crosby's role in both the bank and its regulator as a potential conflict of interest in a report he submitted in October 2004, dubbed in the banking world the Moore Memo. It was Crosby personally that sacked Moore on the back of this. Moore was proved to be correct though, and by 2009, the mismanagement that he had highlighted had overwhelmed the bank, and it faced financial ruin, requiring a £20 billion payout from the British taxpayers to save it from a collapse that would have had disastrous effects on the British economy. James Crosby resigned from his roles at HBOS and the FSA and was dragged before Parliament in disgrace to explain the collapse. He was stripped of his knighthood in 2013. Although the collapse of the bank and subsequent bailout by taxpayers was obviously common knowledge and all over the newspapers at the time, Paul Moore's sacking and his memo was not widely reported until 2018. This has led some to believe that the Paul on the blue envelope related to Paul Moore. Was it possible that Alistair had threatened to turn whistleblower and was silenced before he could? Was the envelope a threat to Paul Moore to make sure that he kept quiet or would face the same fate? On the 28th of November 2016, the 12th anniversary of Alistair's murder, BBC radio presenter John Beattie interviewed Britain's foremost criminologist, Professor David Wilson, about the case, in which he said the key to the case was the blue envelope. During this interview, the radio station received a phone call from someone who claimed that they knew what had happened. John Beattie phoned the number back and spoke to a man who wouldn't give his name or confirm his location. What followed were a series of phone calls between Beattie and the man, in which he named names, detailed a motive, and expressed fears for his own life. The man claimed that a friend of his had been working for a Highland businessman who was involved with a former loyalist paramilitary from Northern Ireland. When the caller's friend became concerned about the nature of the business, which was never revealed, and questioned the businessman, he alleges that his life and that of his family were threatened by the former paramilitary. Records showed that at least one of the businessman's companies did bank with Alistair's bank. Following these phone calls, Beattie gave a statement to police. A colleague of Beattie's from the investigation unit at the BBC, Fiona Walker, continued talking to the caller over the next few months to try to obtain more information. She said, quote, "I started speaking to him on the phone. There were things that were bothering me, things he couldn't answer directly because he wasn't the source of the allegation. It was his friend, and he wouldn't put me in touch with his friend. He was nervous, understandably. He was talking about exposing people who he says have allegedly killed someone. Yet some parts of his information checked out, and my instinct was that he truly believed what he was telling me. But the reality is that the evidence I could stand up was background stuff, and it didn't mean anyone had conspired to have Alistair Wilson killed." When Veronica was asked about the possibility of Alistair being involved with such people, she said, quote, "It doesn't sound like our life. But if you told me that somebody would shoot my husband on our doorstep while we were all in the house, I wouldn't have believed that either." The man leading the police inquiry, Detective Superintendent Gary Cunningham, confirmed that the caller's allegation was one of the investigative strands that his team were progressing. He said they took a statement from the big businessman spoken about, but he was not interviewed as a suspect. In 2018, after a cold case team took another look at the evidence, police revealed that they were interested in speaking to an individual named Sean Douglas in relation to Alistair's murder, though they also stated he was not a suspect. At the time of the murder, he was living with his father Keith in nearby Cumming Street in Nairn. His father had given a statement to the police at the time, stating that Sean was at home with him at the time of the murder, but Sean himself was not questioned by police. He moved to North America shortly after the murder and lost touch with his family. His elderly dad, 82, and brother Craig, 53, urged him to get in touch with detectives, who they claim frequently ask them for information on his whereabouts. In a local newspaper, Craig also confirmed that his brother was not one of the 1,000 local men to volunteer his DNA in the aftermath of the shooting. He said, quote, "I think they've been trying to track him down to get it. I know of other people who refuse to give DNA too, not just Sean." It's not clear what the link between Sean and Alistair was, though he worked as an accountant and may have had business dealings with Alistair in this capacity. Sean is listed in a book published in 2018 by former police detective Peter Blexley, titled To Catch a Killer, as a person of interest, and was also featured in newspaper articles the same year. The police, however, have refused to comment further on their interest in him, as the investigation is still listed as active. It is therefore not clear if links to Sean are as important as the book and newspaper claim, or if it's simply a loose end that they want to tie up. If interviewed, he would almost certainly confirm what his father had already told them, so that alone would not progress the inquiry. Blexley's book also links Alistair's death to the finances of Livingston Football Club, a professional football club in Scotland playing in the Premier League, the highest level of football in the country. The club was in a perilous financial position and was ultimately forced into administration just after winning the League Cup final in March 2004. The club had accrued debts of £7.2 million. There doesn't appear to be too much evidence linking Alistair to Livingston FC's finances, though, and commenting on the claims made by Mr. Blexley, Detective Superintendent Graham Mackey said, quote, "As this is an ongoing, active investigation, we are unable to comment on speculation, and we cannot share sensitive material with the public." However, officers from the inquiry team have previously met and corresponded with Mr. Blexley when he was invited to share any new information he has with us. To date, he has declined to do so. Also in 2018, detectives announced the availability of two new forensic techniques that may have significance for the investigation. Firstly, the details of a new forensic fingerprint test were revealed to the public. The technique involves detecting fingerprints on metal objects by generating a microscopic electric field that will reveal any raised material on the surface. This theoretically provides the potential for recovering fingerprints from gun cartridges, and as a result, this new technique was linked to several unsolved shootings in Scotland, including the murder of Alistair Wilson. However, this method is still in its infancy, and it has never been made known to the public if the shell casings were recovered from Alistair's murder scene. It does seem likely that they were, though, as when Veronica rushed downstairs after hearing the loud bang, she seen the killer walking away. It is very unlikely, with such a public shooting, that he would have spent time looking around for the casings. Also, by 7 p.m. in the north of Scotland in November, it would have been dark. Even with light from the house spilling outside, it would not have been easy to quickly retrieve them. The second forensic advance related to the introduction of an advanced DNA screening technique known as DNA 24. Joanne Cochrane, the head of the forensics team looking into the murder, stated, quote, "The main improvements in the very latest technology are increased sensitivity. 14 years ago, we were using a different DNA profiling kit that only looked at 11 areas of DNA. We're now looking at 24 different areas of DNA. The potential for every cold case is extremely exciting." Police have confirmed that the gun and cigarette butt have been subjected to DNA 24 testing and that a profile has been found, but it has not been matched. Part 5. Theories. There are essentially five theories as to what happened to Alistair Wilson, or more accurately, why it happened, some being more plausible than others. 1. Links to organised crime. 2. Links to a loyalist paramilitary. 3. Threatening to become a whistleblower. 4. An inside job. 5. Mistaken identity. We'll discuss these five theories now and briefly mention a few other fringe theories. Links to organised crime. There is an investigation into Alistair's personal financial situation and his role at HBOS but the police are not disclosing details. Alistair had worked with the Bank of Scotland since leaving university in 1996 and spent time working as a bank manager and working in private finance projects and specialist lending. In 2001, the Bank of Scotland merged with the Halifax and became HBOS. Alistair's murder was 4 years before the financial crash, so banks were still in their heyday of lending. A year before his murder, he was promoted to lead a business banking team responsible for securing loans for small to medium-sized companies from Orkney to Oban. However, his wife revealed that he had become disillusioned with his work and had accepted another job with the newly formed BRE Highlands, an environmental consultancy company. He had resigned from the bank and had 2 weeks of his notice period left when he was shot. He was allegedly unhappy with his promotion prospects at the bank and had taken it hard when a multi-million pound loan he thought he had secured for a firm in Orkney was turned down by head office. Veronica said, quote, "With any big organisation, the rules change and circumstances change, and he wasn't enjoying it there anymore. The challenge wasn't there, and he wasn't doing what he'd set out to do, helping other people more. He couldn't. He didn't fit into the rules now of the bank." Press reports over the years have alleged Alistair had a connection to a gang in Glasgow. One such report stated that Alistair had borrowed £50,000 from moneylenders close to the criminal underworld and suggested he didn't know what he was getting himself into. Dr. Mohammed Rahman suggests that the criminal underworld, like the corporate world, is motivated by the acquisition of power and profit. In his analysis of the case, he said, quote, "The difference is that within the underworld, criminals take an alternative approach to justice, which is murder. There's a variety of things that can get someone killed within the criminal underworld. The common ones tend to be business deals gone wrong, extortion, dishonour, elimination of competition, or members of a rival group. Alistair worked for a bank. He worked in finance, which is a very aggressive and competitive market. If there is any substance in relation to Alistair and connections with the criminal underworld, I strongly believe that it is linked to his workplace or to his previous employments." While refusing to comment on an ongoing investigation, DS Cunningham did confirm that gangland links are a focus of his investigation, but not the only focus. The only information available regarding Alistair's financial situation comes from a newspaper article published in The Independent. The article asserts that, despite being a banker and financially literate, Alistair didn't have a will, and Veronica had to submit an application to Inverness Sheriff Court to become executor of his estate. According to the article, he left behind his home, worth £230,000, £6,000 in his bank account, £5,000 owed to him in bonuses by the bank, and £2,000 from savings, and £2,000 worth of furniture and personal belongings. So while the house at 10 Crescent Road in Nairn was initially bought as a guest house, and the couple initially ran it as such, the failed business didn't appear to have had a substantial financial impact on the couple. There doesn't seem to be any evidence of Alistair having approached a gang for money, nor does there seem to have been any need. Those that point to a link with organised crime as the most likely theory base their claims on the following points. 1. The killer seemed like a professional. He asked for Alistair by name and knew where he lived. He arrived when he was at home and killed with a gun at close range. 2. He demanded something from Alistair by handing him the envelope, further suggesting he was targeted specifically. 3. He was calm. He was not scared off when Veronica answered the door, or when he must have noticed people hanging out around the pub opposite. His demeanour didn't alarm Veronica or Alistair when they spoke with him, and Alistair even returned to talk to him after having closed the door. After shooting Alistair, he walked rather than ran from the scene. 4. Alistair had resigned from the bank. Was he doing dodgy business for gangland contacts, and now they felt that he could pose a threat by exposing them? 5. Alistair's work in the financial industry could have given him access to resources especially valued by criminal gangs. Arguments against this theory consist of 1. Alistair was calm and unalarmed, perhaps not what one would expect from someone in over their heads with dangerous gangsters. The family regularly left their house unlocked for friends to come and go, not the action of a man concerned for his safety. 2. He was confused by his conversation with the killer and by the envelope. It would have been in the gunman's interests to make it clear to Alistair why he was there and what he wanted. If he was simply there to kill him from the start, then why give him the envelope at all, and why allow him to return inside? 3. He was shot on an open street in the early evening, directly opposite a busy pub, and within sight of a CCTV camera. These are not the actions of a professional hitman. True, the CCTV camera was not working at the time, but how could the killer have known that? Apparently the fault was with the software, not something that had been interfered with on the camera itself. 4. The weapon used would not be the obvious choice for a professional hitman, though it did do the job. 5. Veronica has consistently maintained that Alistair was not involved in any illegal activity. He was a mid-level bank manager in a small coastal town in the north of Scotland, with no financial irregularities to speak of, not the most obvious candidate for a gangland association. 6. Despite a detailed investigation over the past 15 to 16 years, police have never put forward any evidence to link Alistair to organised criminal activity. Taking all of this into account, while it may seem like the killer wanted something from Alistair, there just isn't any substantial evidence that he had any links to the Glasgow underworld, either in his behaviour or in his personal finances. So how about the claims that he was potentially involved with a loyalist paramilitary? This theory was put on the table after an anonymous phone call to the BBC radio show, in which the caller implicated a Highland businessman and his associate, a loyalist ex-paramilitary from Northern Ireland. The BBC certainly took it seriously at the time, reporting it to the police and conducting their own research through their investigative journalism department. It's known that the police did approach the businessman in question, but details of that conversation have not been made public. The BBC did make public that while there were some very interesting and potentially significant things brought up, ultimately it was all second-hand information. The following points can be made in support of this claim. 1. The persistence of the tipster. Journalists from the BBC certainly took his claim seriously and held a series of conversations with the caller in which he allegedly named names and claimed to be afraid for his life. 2. It has been confirmed that the Highland businessman did use HBOS for at least one of his registered companies. 3. The troubles in Northern Ireland were a particularly violent time. It's certainly very possible that an ex-paramilitary could have experience with killing up close and would have contacts to access a weapon. Arguments against this theory consist of 1. The police investigated some of the tipster's claims, including interviewing the businessman in question, who has never been named publicly, and do not regard him as a suspect. 2. The caller has always remained anonymous and alleges the information comes from a friend of his. The caller refuses to put anyone in touch with his friend, and the friend has never come forward. There are holes in his story which can be conveniently skirted around in this way. 3. The choice of weapon would be unusual for an ex-paramilitary. Without wanting to get into the hugely complex and contentious subject of the politics of Northern Ireland, suffice to say, over the years, many weapons have been transported through the country. Would an antique handgun dating back to the 1920s really have been the weapon of choice for such an experienced killer? In addition to this, in 2016, a second Haino Schmeisser was found in Nairn and handed in to the police. It was identical to the one found in the drain 12 years earlier, but couldn't be linked to any known crime. It was apparently handed in to the police when a family found it amongst an elderly relative's possessions. It is interesting that only 11 Hainals have been recovered in the UK, and two of them were found in a small seaside town in the north of Scotland. A possible explanation for this is that it was not unusual for Polish soldiers to be stationed in Scotland during the war, and most of them were sent to defend the east coast. The pistols were manufactured in what was part of Germany in the 1920s, but is now part of Poland, and these soldiers could well have had access to these kind of weapons. It is possible that several were found after these servicemen passed away, or were given as gifts to the locals. This is a more plausible explanation of the source of the weapon. So where does the loyalist paramilitary fit in, especially if the businessman has been cleared? 4. The businessman banked with HBOS. HBOS is part of the Lloyds banking group, who have 30 million customers worldwide. HBOS themselves have 72,000 employees. No direct link has ever been made publicly that Alistair was personally involved in the businessman's finances, though admittedly the Highlands of Scotland are a relatively sparsely populated area. This theory largely comes from one man's tip-off to the BBC. Even then, it's second-hand information that he claimed was told to him by a friend. The police did take a statement from the businessman and declared that he was not a suspect. If there had been any links evident between him and Alistair, would he have been ruled out so quickly? Could he have been surrounded by layers of legal protection that were too difficult to penetrate? Would Alistair's records have been so difficult to access? Police presumably obtained the name of the former paramilitary too, if he even exists. They have stated that they managed to obtain a DNA profile, either from the cigarette butt or from the gun, or from both, but they have not matched him to anyone yet. Does this rule out the paramilitary, or was his DNA never tested? Would it be likely that an experienced killer would discard a cigarette butt at the murder scene anyway? Would an experienced killer even kill in such a public place and in such a public way? How about the theory that Alistair was about to turn whistleblower and to expose the bank's reckless financial policies, as Paul Moore had done? Arguments for this theory are as follows. 1. Alistair had resigned from the bank and only had 2 weeks left. Supporters of this theory point to Alistair's resignation as evidence that he had a moral objection to the bank's conduct, and as such, resigned his position in order to take up a job in an entirely unrelated field. Perhaps he had threatened to expose them. 2. A deal that he thought he had secured for an Orkney-based company was vetoed at the last minute by head office, causing enough resentment in Alistair for him to resign and threaten to expose them. 3. The testimony of Paul Moore. Paul Moore held a senior position at HBOS and was allegedly dismissed for threatening to expose the bank's conduct. He believed the Paul on the envelope quite possibly related to him. He was quoted in the Daily Mail, a British national newspaper, as saying the following, quote, "I didn't know Mr. Wilson, but at the time I was the good practice manager. If there were any concerns about the way the bank was operating, I would be the person that people should come to. I would not be surprised if there were people at the bank at the time who would have been prepared to go to the ultimate degree in this way, not necessarily themselves, but getting someone to do it. I haven't been questioned by the police, and you would think they'd want to speak to me, wouldn't you?" Arguments against this theory are: 1. Alistair's wife has said that the reason that he resigned from the bank was simply because he had become disillusioned with the job and wanted a new challenge. Sure, he was disappointed that the loan for the Orkney company fell through, but this was just a small part of a growing dissatisfaction with his job, the kind of unremarkable dissatisfaction that many people feel in their jobs. And if the bank had such a reckless approach to money to the extent that someone was killed over threatening to expose it, why was the loan rejected in the first place? 2. While the reasons for Paul Moore's sacking in 2004 were not widely reported in the media until many years later, it's conceivable, even probable, that Alistair knew of the reasons why he was dismissed. He may even have agreed with Paul Moore's position. but as pointed out by Paul Moore himself, he and Alistair did not know each other. He was the person that anyone with concerns should report to, yet Alistair had never spoken to him. If he had threatened to expose the bank, surely he would have first of all contacted Paul Moore. Paul Moore has given several interviews over the last few years in which he does not hold back in his attacks on the management structure of HBOS. If Alistair had spoken to him, he would not keep it to himself, in my view. Paul Moore was a senior figure at the bank, who, when he threatened to reveal their practices, was simply fired, not killed. Alistair was in a considerably more junior position, so why was he killed? Paul Moore has never reported that he has been personally threatened in any way. This theory would have you believe that a multinational bank with thousands of employees and millions of customers worldwide would be so alarmed that a mid-level bank manager from a small coastal town in a small country was about to spill the beans that they sent someone to kill him. On the balance of evidence, it's difficult to accept that HBOS played any role in Alistair's death. Links between him and Paul Moore are tenuous at best, and there's no evidence that Alistair threatened to expose them. Even if he had, is it likely a huge company like HBOS would have been particularly concerned? How about the inside job theory? This theory suggests that Alistair's murder had nothing to do with his work at all. There are several different avenues to this theory. Was his wife behind his murder? Was he having an affair and was murdered by a jealous husband? Was he killed over a dispute with the owner of the adjacent Havelock Hotel? Regarding the Havelock Hotel dispute, just days before Alistair was shot, he wrote a letter of complaint to the local council in which he complained that drinkers at the hotel, using a newly constructed raised decking area, were throwing empty bottles into his garden. The decking had been built in May of the same year, but the owner of the hotel had not applied for planning permission. The owner and Alistair had been golfing friends, but it appeared their relationship soured to the extent that Alistair made a formal complaint. The council held a meeting shortly after Alistair's death to review whether or not to grant retrospective permission for the decking, or if it would need to be removed. They decided to grant the permission, dismissing Alistair's complaints. Regarding the jealous husband revenge killing, the police turned over every stone in Alistair's life and never found any evidence of him having had an affair. Nairn is a very small town, and rumours and speculation often spread like wildfire through such small communities. Indeed, the very opposite appears to be true. He was considered by everyone that knew him to be a very devoted husband and father who valued his family life above all else. Could the same be said of his wife? As is often the case when a husband or wife is murdered, the surviving partner is subjected to suspicion, rumours, innuendo, and often direct investigation by the police, and Alistair's murder was no different. Some people felt it was suspicious that Veronica decided to continue living in the house her husband was murdered in, rather than making a fresh start somewhere else. Some see this as insensitive and not the actions of someone that is grieving. They wonder why she wasn't afraid for her own safety and for the safety of her children. Wasn't she worried that the man might come back to try to get whatever it was he wanted in the first place? They feel her behaviour is indicative of guilty knowledge. She wasn't scared for her safety because there was nothing to be scared of. Veronica herself has said that she decided to stay on as she had happy memories with her husband in their home and didn't want to uproot her children. She had received tremendous support from the local community and had just wanted life to be as stable as possible. Others point to the fact that Veronica has said very little about the murder over the years and has not been particularly vocal in keeping the profile of the investigation up. While this is true, it has to be taken into account that the police had requested that Veronica keep certain information to herself, especially regarding her conversation with Alistair between his two visits to the front door. Indeed, it was only revealed by the police themselves many years after the murder that the blue envelope was empty and that it had Paul written on it. It's also very possible that she simply wanted to shield her children from everything that was going on as much as possible, so kept a low profile in the media. She told the BBC in an interview, quote, "Now that my children are becoming adults, I just don't want them to have the life that I've had to lead, knowing that people are talking about you." It seems reasonable that by continuing to live in the family home and keeping a low profile, she was simply trying to protect herself and her children. So how about the theory that Veronica had Alistair killed? Proponents of this theory believe the murder was motivated by money or because she was having an affair with someone else. A rumour in the local press speculated that Veronica had been having an affair with Stuart Wright, the chef from the Havelock Hotel, who was one of the first people on the scene following the shooting. Those that believe this theory think that Alistair possibly found out about the affair and was killed as a result, presumably by Wright himself. This rumour of an affair turned out to be completely false. Nonetheless, DNA was taken from Stuart Wright, and items from his home were forensically examined before he was cleared of any involvement. Speaking in a local newspaper about the false allegations, he said, quote, "I won't be chased from here, just like it didn't chase Veronica away. All I'll say is that there has been a dark cloud over Nairn since the night Alistair was killed, and it won't be lifted until the gunman is caught." As for him being shot over a life insurance policy, this theory would have you believe that Veronica hired a hitman to kill her husband. This would also presumably mean that she made up the entire story about the blue envelope. And why would she answer the door to a hitman she had hired? Or was that all made up too? If so, why do it? It would have been much simpler to tell the police that she'd never seen the shooter at all. Even simpler would be to give the hitman information as to Alistair's movements so he could confront him when he was alone, rather than at home with their children present, one of whom wandered outside and seen his own father lying dying on the doorstep. As mentioned above, Alistair didn't have a will, so there was never any guarantee that Veronica would be able to obtain his money after his death anyway. And although the couple had money in their bank account and savings account, they were not what one might consider especially wealthy. There is no substantial evidence that Veronica was involved in Alistair's murder in any way, nor is there any motive. She underwent regressive cognitive therapy at the request of the police in an attempt to recall any further details about the night Alistair was murdered. She has lived with the finger of suspicion pointing at her for many years and says that she now simply exists rather than lives. Still, she understands as long as the killer is at large and the subject of the conversation between Alistair and the killer remains confidential, it will always be there. For their part, the police have said Veronica is not a suspect. Is it possible that Alistair was not the intended target, that this was a case of mistaken identity? Proponents of this theory point to 1. Alistair's normal, calm behaviour right up until the evening of his death. He did not behave in any way out of the ordinary and didn't appear to be fearful for his safety. His weekend was just like any other, spending time with friends and family. The family were still leaving the back door to the house unlocked as usual, not the actions of an anxious man. 2. Alistair's confusion about his conversation with the man on the doorstep and the purpose of the envelope. He was confused by the incident rather than alarmed. 3. Alistair's working life has been scrutinised by the police for 16 years and no evidence of anything dubious that could lead to murder has been found. The argument against this theory is 1. The killer asked for Alistair Wilson by name. The police have never uncovered a viable target with the same name. Veronica herself believes this theory. Hers and Alistair's lives have been examined with a fine-tooth comb and by different police teams over the years, but despite all of the scrutiny, no dark secret in their lives has been uncovered. She is convinced that if Alistair had survived the shooting, he would have no idea why he'd been shot. This theory hasn't been ruled out by the police either, but again, it's one of several lines of inquiry that are being investigated. They have spoken to a number of other Alistair Wilsons in the Highlands and throughout Scotland. Both Alistair and Wilson are fairly common names in Scotland. However, there was only one other person with that name living in Nairn in 2004. He was in his 60s at the time and lived only a few minutes' walk away. The police interviewed him and concluded he was just a normal man who had lived a very normal life. He was not the intended target. The mistaken identity theory seems very unlikely. If an experienced killer was hired to kill someone, they would presumably be given decent information as to who the person is, not only their name, but also their address and a description of their appearance. Would a hired killer really make such a mistake by killing the wrong person? And perhaps even in the wrong town? Is that really probable? Something as serious as an assassination would surely be much more organised than that. That being said, the killer did perform the job rather sloppily. He turned up at the victim's front door, showed his face to his wife, and shot him within sight of a CCTV camera, so perhaps he was at the budget end of the hitman market. Of course, if the killer was not a hitman at all, but rather someone that wanted Alistair dead and was performing the murder for themselves, they would certainly have known what he looked like and where he lived. Also, in the 16 years since the murder, no other Alistair Wilsons have been killed in suspicious circumstances. So the real target was never eliminated. I suppose it has to be considered that a random Alistair Wilson was killed in order to act as a warning to the real Alistair Wilson, whoever he may be, but it seems like a very elaborate and risky way of sending a message, and it doesn't account for the blue envelope at all. Some other, more fringe theories surround the case. These include suspicion around Sean Douglas, links to Livingston FC, blackmail, revelations in a thesis submitted to Professor David Wilson, a random killing, and a police cover-up. Looking first at Sean Douglas, it has not been determined exactly why the police became keen to talk to him. Hundreds of men in the local area were swabbed and had their DNA profiled in order to be eliminated from the inquiry, and it is known that Sean never did. Both his brother and his father had their DNA profiled, and were eliminated at the time. However, their elimination was based upon testing for 11 DNA markers. It's possible that their DNA was amongst the samples retested in 2018 using the new DNA 24 technique. Perhaps their DNA was a close match to the DNA found at the scene, either on the gun or on the cigarette butt, and this was what caused the sudden interest in getting in touch with Sean. This is just one possibility of why the police were keen to speak to him. However, it could simply be that they had a loose end to tie up, and that Sean is not a suspect at all. After all, the police's attempts to track Sean down appear to extend to asking his father if he's heard from him every now and again. Hardly the actions of an investigation team desperate to track someone down. In addition to this, it was Veronica who answered the door to the killer. Sean only lived a few streets away from the Wilsons at the time, and may very well have been known to Veronica. At the very least, if police suspected him of being involved, Veronica would have been shown a photograph of him. This would appear to rule out Sean as the shooter, unless he was in cahoots with Veronica. But this again raises the question of why invent a story about a blue envelope. There is very limited evidence of any link between Alistair and the finances of Livingston FC. Indeed, other than what is presented in Blexley's book, there is no information on the subject at all. It's highly speculative, and the police's disinterest in this line of inquiry suggests that it's not really a viable theory. The blackmail theory suggests that Alistair had a visitor, someone who thought he was having an affair with his wife or some such, and the blue envelope contained incriminating evidence, such as a photograph. The visitor then threatened him with exposing the affair and demanded payment. When Alistair refused, a confrontation occurred, and the would-be blackmailer ended up shooting him. There's no evidence at all to back this theory up, though. The police thoroughly examined Alistair's life, and no dark secrets were uncovered. It also does not explain why Paul was written on the envelope. A very interesting theory developed in 2017. One of the UK's leading criminologists, Professor David Wilson, appeared on the John Beattie BBC radio show to discuss the case. Shortly afterwards, he received an 8-page essay in the Post entitled Cold Case Thesis from an author simply calling themselves Nate. David Wilson is relatively well known in the UK from appearing on crime-related TV documentaries and hosted his own show at one point entitled David Wilson Investigates, in which he analysed the crimes of serial killers. He wrote an article in the Herald newspaper in late 2017 in which he discussed aspects of the Alistair Wilson case and the essay he had received in the Post. The essay carried a Glasgow postmark, and according to Professor Wilson, it related the events surrounding Alistair's murder. The essay contained two pieces of evidence: that the name Paul was written on the envelope, which had not been revealed by the police at that time, and that there was a witness who claimed to have seen the killer and could identify him. The essay also made reference that Alistair's work should be investigated, as he was not as, quote, squeaky clean as he made out to be. Professor Wilson used his contacts in the police to ascertain if what Nate had told him was true, and they confirmed that it was. He subsequently had a conversation with an unnamed senior police officer who informed him that although a witness had come forward, no effit of the suspect had been drawn up, as, quote, it probably wouldn't be a good likeness. Shortly afterwards, the witness referred to in the essay, Tommy Hogg, came forward and appeared in the same BBC radio show to give his version of events. Mr. Hogg claimed that he sat behind a man on a bus from Inverness to Nairn on the day of the murder. The man got off the bus, and he was last seen heading in the direction of Alistair's home. Mr. Hogg said, quote, every time I looked at him, he turned his head away and stared out of the window. He was so ill at ease, so jumpy. He described the man as being about 5'9" to 5'10" tall, wearing a dark cap and a blouson-style jacket. He went on to say, quote, the thing that struck me about him was that he was absolutely immaculate. Short hair, and he looked like he had just stepped out of the bath. He was pristine. In the wake of this radio appearance, Professor Wilson spoke with Mr. Hogg directly. He told him that he had given a full statement to the police and that he had viewed an effit of the man and described it as the spitting image of the person he had seen. But the police had told Professor Wilson that no effit was drawn up, so where did it come from? The only other possibility would be from Veronica's description, but then why was that not circulated to the public? The police issued a statement after Mr. Hogg's radio appearance, stating that the person whom Mr. Hogg had identified had been traced and eliminated from their inquiries. This was evidently done without the help from the public, so presumably the police themselves knew who the person was. Was he a well-known criminal? Was he an ex-policeman? Perhaps it was Nate himself. Professor Wilson's newspaper article is very scathing of the police investigation, and he offers his opinion that the investigation has been more about protecting the police than investigating the murder. He finishes it with the line, quote, above all, I sincerely hope that we are dealing with a cock-up for 13 years rather than a conspiracy. Part 6. Conclusion. The murder of Alistair Wilson is a confusing case, made all the more so by the secrecy that surrounds it and the reluctance of the police to share information with the public. While it's understandable that it can be important to keep some evidence under wraps, it seems to be excessive in this case. The investigation has been the most expensive unsolved case in Scottish history, yet the police do not appear to be any further forward in identifying who was behind it. They claim it's still an open investigation, and Detective Superintendent Gary Cunningham, leading the investigation, said in 2018, quote, we remain committed to investigating the murder of Alistair Wilson, and a review into the evidence collected so far remains ongoing. Any new information provided will be robustly investigated as part of our inquiries. Stripping back the case to its basic elements reveals the execution-style murder of a soon-to-be ex-banker on his own doorstep by a stranger seemingly following a discussion and demand for something. It seems that there are two obvious questions to be answered. Firstly, who was the man that came to the door? And secondly, who had a motive to kill him? Well, it appears that the police may have the answer to the first question. They claim that the man identified by Tommy Hogg from a previously drawn up e-fit had been eliminated from the inquiry. It's difficult to understand this statement. The only person that could have drawn up the e-fit was Veronica. And if that was the case, then how could they possibly say he was eliminated from the inquiry, since he would have had to have been the killer? The e-fit was never made public, so how did the police find the man, unless they knew who he was? Knowing who the person was may also lead to the answer to the second question, regarding motive, but only if the person was willing to talk. More likely, the answer would be found by forensically examining all of Alistair's business clients. Who did he have dealings with in the latter part of his career? Who stood to lose anything if Alistair left his job? What was it they feared he might discuss after he left? From looking at the evidence that is available and presented above, a reasonable hypothesis of the events goes as follows. Alistair was murdered by a hired gunman. The contractor was likely a regional businessman involved in underhand schemes of some sort that had decided to have Alistair killed when he resigned from his role at the bank and could, at any time, have revealed what he might have been engaged in. Alistair possibly got caught up in something that escalated over time and he decided to move on from the bank before it went any further. His relaxed attitude around the time of the murder suggests that he didn't feel in danger. Perhaps he just thought resigning and moving on with his life was enough to put it all behind him. His confusion about the conversation with the visitor on the doorstep and being handed the envelope was perhaps more surprise and astonishment. He possibly didn't realise how serious the businessman considered his resignation to be and was taken aback by being threatened on his own doorstep. Perhaps he was given the envelope as a warning, as in, "I'm sending you a message," and it was merely symbolic. There are some theories that the PAUL written on the envelope could be an acronym for Pay and You Live. The payment requested possibly evidence Alistair possessed that could be dangerous to the contractor. As is often the case when one is confronted unexpectedly, it takes a few moments to get over the shock. Once he processed the information, he went back downstairs to confront the visitor, give him the envelope back, and tell him to be on his way and leave him and his family alone, perhaps holding whatever the gunman came for, but refusing to give it to him. At this point, he was shot. The gunman may have been there principally to negotiate, although he was armed and prepared to do whatever he felt was necessary. It appears he may have arrived by bus, if Tommy Hogg is to be believed, and left the scene on foot. Is it really likely one would conduct a hit by public transport? Perhaps he had an accomplice waiting nearby with a car. The drain in which the gun was found was on the passenger side of the road, meaning it is possible it is dropped by someone sitting on the passenger side of a car and not from the driver's side. It would also mean that the man Tommy Hogg seen was not the killer. Not to mention that if murder was the aim, then why hand over the envelope? It appears the killer was very calm in going about his business and likely experienced. It is possible the police knew who the killer was. Perhaps he's in prison for something else. Perhaps he's a valuable informer, so the police don't want to reveal him. Perhaps he is a loyalist paramilitary spoken about. And perhaps the Highland businessman revealed by the anonymous caller to the BBC radio show was the contractor. The truth may well lie in the analysis of Alistair's work. It's difficult to accept that H-Boss played any role in his murder. And although they claim to have assisted the police in their inquiries, they would have a vested interest in making sure their accounts, pre-financial crash, were not examined too closely, lest more malpractice be revealed. But this could inadvertently have prevented concrete evidence against a client with a motive from being revealed. On the back of Alistair's case, and two high-profile assassinations in the UK, those of TV presenter Jill Dando in 1999 and of Frank McPhee in 2000, Professor Wilson started to study contract killings and managed to obtain interviews with a couple of reformed hitmen. What he discovered were that the costs of contracting a hit were surprisingly low, often just a few £100s, and the motives were often bordering on the banal, unfaithfulness or business arrangements breaking down. He also discovered, surprisingly to him, that more often than not they took place not in the underworld, but in the suburban pubs and streets of the overworld, often in broad daylight and often in front of disbelieving witnesses. The hitmen would often choose a victim's doorstep to commit the hit because, as a former hitman coldly told him, quote, "You know where your victim is, and they don't expect to be shot on their doorstep, so their guard is down. They're thinking about the day ahead if you do it in the morning, or making tea or getting their kids ready for bed if it's at night." This, sadly, seems to reflect Alistair's final evening. Part 7. Aftermath. Nairn is a well-heeled coastal resort with a reputation for good weather, or at least for the north of Scotland, and is not a place used to violent crime. The last murder before Alistair was shot was in 1986, when someone was killed in an argument at a wedding. Come the summer, the noise of the gulls competes with the pipe band and the smell of fish and chips fills the air. The town hosts a Highland Games and an annual agricultural show. You can take a boat cruise and go dolphin spotting, yet the shadow of Alistair's murder still drapes over the town like a cowl. Alistair's funeral was held on the 6th of May 2005 at St Andrews, and a memorial service was held in Nairn in 2012, in which hundreds attended. For Veronica, the death of her husband dominates her thoughts. Her boys are now young men that have had to grow up without their father, and with not knowing who is responsible for his murder. It's left a burning sense of injustice with the family. Quote, "Al was a loving, caring husband and father, and nothing will change that. We cherish the time we had together, which, for our boys, was cut cruelly short. For us as a family, we need to know why. This is just so senseless. Our life just won't ever be anything without answers. We will always remain hopeful that the person who killed Al will be caught." If you're interested in learning more about the case of Alistair Wilson, there's many websites and news articles that cover the case, most interestingly the doorstep murder by the BBC. If you have any information relevant to the case, get in touch with Crime Stoppers. Do you agree with my conclusions? Do you have your own theory? Email me at thesilentevidence@gmail.com, tweet me at thesilentevpod, or comment on Facebook to let me know what you think. If you enjoyed the show, please consider supporting me on Patreon at www.patreon.com/thesilentevidence, and join me for the next episode of the Silent Evidence podcast.